You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
Even before the Olympic bid, there was significant opposition to Vancouver hosting the 2010 Olympic Games. Here in the downtown East Side, many knew they were going to reap few of the benefits and bear many of the costs. But the picture was so rosy and hard to resist. Helen Jeffson-Lenski says that the impacts of what she calls the Olympic industry are very consistent, a regular pattern recurring every 4 years in different cities around the world. Helen Jeffson-Lenski is a community activist and author of The Best Ever Olympics, Social Impacts of the Sydney 2000, Inside the Olympic Industry, Power, Politics and Activism, and her new book is Olympic Industry Resistance, Challenging Olympic Power and Propaganda. She's joined me on the phone from Toronto. Good afternoon, Helen.
Good afternoon, Peter.
So now, what has been the documented about the Olympic, the impacts of Olympic Games on cities that host them?
Well, the most thoroughgoing research report on that particular question came out of the Center on Housing Rights and Evictions in Geneva in 2007. And there's absolutely indisputable evidence of the negative impacts on the housing and homelessness situation in host cities, the human rights, particularly human rights of vulnerable populations, homeless people, prostitutes, and so on, and the enormous cost to the taxpayer.
Now, are these, like, is this what we're seeing in terms of when we had the expo here, we saw displacement and evictions? Is this the standard thing? Is it that nature of housing issue?
That's one important aspect. And the research on mega events, and that includes expos, world championships, Olympics, and so on, it's primarily negative. And it seems to be this kind of dream that the politicians and boosters make, that this will be a catalyst for urban development, that the housing homelessness problem will be solved, in quotes, by hosting a mega event, that it's the lever that causes politicians at all levels to fork out money for housing. Those promises have very, very rarely come about.
And I was surprised that that homelessness has not just been criminalized in Vancouver, but that's something that's attached to the Olympic legacy, as it were.
Yes, or even the pre-Olympic legacy. Every recent host city for summer games, and in some cases the host cities for winter games like Salt Lake City, have been very aware of this, the slogan, "The eyes of the world are upon us." And that's meant to be positive in the sense that we have to be on our best behavior, you know, and be kind to visitors and so on. But the really negative and disturbing angle in that is that the organizing committee and the local politicians see that it's can be a national embarrassment to have people living on the streets, people panhandling, people in the open drug trade, as opposed to the richer folks who can do drugs behind closed doors. And all of those populations are subject to these clampdowns, these street sweeps. And we saw that Barcelona, Atlanta, Sydney, Athens, Salt Lake City, and a few other places.
That's extraordinary. Now, I want to touch on some of the other impacts that the games affect. How about with local economies? What sort of consequences they have on local economies?
Well, Sydney is the Olympics that I'm most familiar with, since I did an entire book, Best Olympics Ever, on Sydney. And in the case of Sydney, the taxpayer paid, or public money, accounted for about 50% of the final budget. And the rhetoric says that the taxpayers get a legacy of infrastructure and sporting facilities, and so they shouldn't whine about public money going into these things. But I also see repeatedly this pattern of very clever Olympic bookkeeping, which is quite different to what most reputable accountants would, how they would approach it. And in fact, in the case of Sydney 2000, the Auditor General of New South Wales was asked to audit the figures, And he said rather scathingly to the organizing committee, you can't include indirect benefits as though they're on the plus side of the line and just thoroughly ignore indirect costs, even though they should be on the negative side of the line. And we see that in every host city, and Vancouver's no exception, that all the additional costs that involve various levels of government, various levels of local, provincial, national security, police, military, and so on, tend to be kind of overlooked. And then the huge kind of volunteer labor force of teachers and sport leaders and so on, they rarely reap the benefits that are kind of promised.
Very interesting. And you mentioned the infrastructure that's developed. Does that meet long-term needs? Like, that's one of the things we're seeing a lot of work on, infrastructure here in Vancouver. How does that pan out in previous examples?
Well, just starting with Vancouver, I don't recall a referendum or a sweeping public demand to improve the Sea to Sky Highway. And that's going to cost millions of taxpayers' money. And that's presented as a so-called legacy, as though it was kind of this gift that Vancouver and the BC people got. And we've seen that pattern in a lot of previous host cities, that the Olympic blueprint for what has to be built, one, includes facilities that are not necessarily going to reflect the needs of the local population, like ski jumps are not as widely used as just ordinary ski hills and alpine trails and so on. Velodromes are not used as much as bike lanes in an urban area. But we get these kind of esoteric events that require a special facility, and there's no getting around that. And then the same with the huge influx of tourists. Okay, you have to expand the airport, expand the highways to the airport, and so on. Not necessarily the top priority for local residents or elected politicians who are trying to reflect the needs of local residents.
There's been a lot of criticism of the games in China that seem to suggest we do things better in the West. Is that the case?
I think that's one of sort of a favorite image among Canadians, that we're a kinder, gentler people than the Americans or the Chinese or Europeans or whatever. But as I said, the blueprint is set from on high. The IOC dictates how an Olympic should be run, right down, right down to details like forbidding protests in ordinary Olympic venues. So, in effect, interfering with the domestic policy of a country around peaceful protests. So there are things that Olympic committees cannot change, and so it's not necessarily that an Olympic committee is full of evil people. It's just that they have the power to do that because the IOC is dictating it.
How would you characterize successful resistance strategies to the Olympics?
Well, multifaceted, I guess, is the magic word, that resisting on a lot of fronts, because some of them are not going to work. And I know that, having been an active member of Breadnut Circuses from 1998 until we kind of stopped organizing around Olympics after Beijing was awarded the 08 Games in 2001. So, and I was involved with the resistance in Sydney in the period from about March to June, July 2000. And coalition building is a difficult thing to do at the best of times, and the timelines are so tight for Olympic organizing. I mean, in theory, we have 7 years. If a city is unlucky enough to get awarded the Games, there's 7 years until they're actually on, and then the aftermath, of course, also has to be monitored, and the worst problems kind of try to mitigate the worst outcomes. And I saw in the case of Sydney, there were coalitions with Aboriginal groups, and within the Aboriginal groups, there were groups that were really on side of, had been kind of co-opted by the organizing committee, and We saw that in the opening ceremonies with the very, very visible presence of Aboriginal people. And every bid committee that has an Indigenous population tends to send the singers and the dancers as this tokenistic kind of gesture of inclusion, and it's not. It's totally window dressing. So working with across all these groups that are very diverse, I remember sitting at a table in Sydney next to a woman from the Salvation Army, and she's not normally somebody who I would think of as a fellow activist who I would be organizing with and working on housing and homelessness issues, but that was how it played itself out. So everybody was sort of being careful and respectful and trying to work out the differences in private and definitely not sort of hang the dirty laundry for everybody to see, using that metaphor of the sort of the struggles within the left-wing groups that have to be resolved before we can move forward. But not giving the other side the opportunity to see those rifts, because obviously they'll use the divide and rule tactic.
Do you see a way forward for activists in Vancouver to limit the damaging impacts of our 2010 Winter Games?
I think they're doing an excellent job to date with the monitoring, and the referendum certainly sort of demonstrated how dedicated activists with a very small budget can have a pretty big impact on outcomes. So I guess the eternal vigilance kind of argument is or approach is the way to go, and the importance of coalition building, I'd really emphasize that based on my Toronto and Sydney experience, but I'm sure Vancouver activists are aware of that already, don't need me to tell them. I know there's a spectrum of activists in Vancouver, as there were in Sydney and Toronto, and it's always very tempting to sort of be lured into the magic and the so-called goosebumps effect. I mean, that's what I call it, based on what I hear from sort of well-meaning liberal supporters of the Olympics who say, but it's wonderful, it's magic, it'll be different on the day, everybody will be pulled into this wonderful spirit of international friendship and cooperation, all this kind of rhetoric, which is false, but it can be very alluring for kind of a more liberal community person who's working from that base rather than, as I would promote, from a radical base that really looks at the roots of the problem and sees global capitalism and so on. And all kinds of systems of oppression at work manifest in the Olympics.
Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Helen Jefferson-Lenski, and Helen Jefferson-Lenski is the author of Olympic Industry Resistance, Challenging Olympic Power and Propaganda, and that was published during the summer by State University of New York Press.